Oh.
People with type 2 diabetes are excited about the potential of once-weekly Ozempic.
My A1C was up here. Now it's down with Rybelsus.
His A1C?
It's down with Rybelsus. Look
out, 'cause here I've always had trouble with my weight.
Now with Wegovy, I've seen real change. I've lost weight, and I'm keeping it off.
Wegovy helped reduce my appetite.
Okay, so that's pretty catchy because they took the song from The Greatest Showman, This Is Me, and made it Wegovy. Super catchy marketing. Good for you, Wegovy. Not a sponsor. But that's exactly what we're talking about in this episode. We're talking about these brand new diabetic medications that are called non-insulin second agent or second choice or second line medications. And it has exploded. I mean, this whole story of the control of diabetes is a true success story. We've made huge. Oh my goodness. I can't even get out of the intro now. It's already derailed. It's gotten huge discoveries because look, man, it wasn't long ago. It was not long ago that if you had diabetes, you're a goner. We're going to go through that history because I think it's fascinating. Nobody knew what was happening. I mean, just kind of wasted away. And then you got ketoacidotic, and you died. So when insulin came on the scene, and guys, we're talking about like 1920s, all right? I know it seems like forever ago, the 100-year mark, but it's really not all that long ago because that revolutionized the care for this endocrine disorder. Of course, now people still die with diabetes when it's uncontrolled because of chronic sequelae like chronic kidney injury and cardiovascular manifestations, but by far, it's totally controllable. So here's a question. As these new second-line non-insulin diabetic medications like GLP-1 agonists that we just heard in the intro, like Ozempic, and even the new GLT-2 inhibitors, that stands for sodium glucose cotransporter 2, as these medications are definitely on the scene and everybody knows about them because they help you lose weight as well as control your blood sugar, there's no question that reproductive age women are going to be on this, right? Now, here's the question. Even though they're supposed to be on good birth control while on these medications, stuff happens, life happens, and then they can get pregnant. Now, remember, as weight control happens, one of the possibilities is spontaneous ovulation, right? That's why this is being looked at, of course, for PCOS, for our home here in gynecology, and that can lead to a mistimed pregnancy. So here's the question. As these medications are without doubt being used with increasing frequency in reproductive age women, what happens with first trimester exposure of these meds in somebody who comes in and goes, hey, my period is kind of returned. It's been back to regular. Now it's off. And now I'm pregnant. Well, the first thing is try to not let that happen because they should be on effective birth control methods during this medication therapy, at least until we know more, and that's where I'm going. So questions that arise, like in our case here that I'm going to tell you about in just a minute, is, oh my goodness, I'm on this medication. Is this safe, or am I going to cause increased risk of stillbirth? Am I going to cause increased risk of miscarriage or malformations? That's the big fear, right? Now, because these medications are relatively new on the scene, we don't have a lot of human long-term data, especially in pregnancy. But at the end of 2023, and then officially came out in print last month, February 2024, we now have some data. Now, here's why I wanted to talk about this. It wasn't but, 3 or 4 days ago that I received a Facebook message on somebody who I don't know personally, but it's part of our podcast community, and said, hey, Dr. Chapa, this patient came in. She said, by the way, I'm on Ozempic and my home pregnancy test, which I took because my period had become regular and now it was late, shows I'm positive. So here's a question that I received through our messenger. what do I tell this patient? I mean, she got pregnant with a medication. I looked at the FDA label and it says, make sure they're not to get pregnant. What is the data? Can you help me with that? And I said, oh, actually, there is brand new data on that, for which I shared to our listener. And then said, that would be a great topic. So here we are right now. I'll be very clear. As of right now, and this is March 2024, do not use this on purpose in pregnancy. All right. Now I'm going to give you a 2018 case report that was published from a journal that I didn't know existed. I mean, but that's okay. I mean, there's a lot of journals out there, but this was called Gynecological Perinatology. Now, figure that title, Gynecological Perinatology. Huh? I mean, those are like two different boxes, but whatever. But there was a physician who, on purpose, their diabetologist, who used one of these medications, one GLP-1, on purpose because her sugars were so jacked during pregnancy. Now, I don't advise that, nor does the FDA, nor will anybody. But it's interesting what people do. This was not in the U.S. And I'll give you that outcome here in a moment. Plus, remember, not all GLP-1 medications are the same, because there is data that specifically two of them, and one of them is not Ozempic, but two others in this class may not even cross the placenta well. Well, that's helpful, but again, we still need more data. So as of right now, the FDA says do not use this on purpose in pregnancy, and if they're thinking about being pregnant, do not use it, because of this uncertainty that we're going to talk about here. And if they are using it, there should be at least a 2 to 3 month washout interval. In other words, time from last use before pregnancy occurs and or is attempted. Okay, so I'll be very clear. I'm not advocating for these medications to be used in pregnancy right now, but you know it's going to happen to you, just like it happened to our podcast family member where a patient comes in, I'm on this med. And by the way, and I asked, well, was this patient not on contraception? Did they not tell her about birth control? Here it is, guys. Listen to this. And this is what is just, it's just so frustrating. Because when this physician asked, hey, were you not on contraception? This family member is a family medicine OB provider. Said, oh, well, I asked, were you not on birth control? And here's what the patient said, just almost directly from the text I received. Well, my physician, my doctor said that it wasn't that important to be on birth control or not. What? Absolutely, absolutely incorrect. These patients, if you are on one of these new medications, whether it's a GLP-1 medication or an SGLT2 medication, they cannot use it if they are considering pregnancy in the short term. Okay. Now, it's not contraindicated in reproductive age females. They just have to be non-pregnant and not considering pregnancy in the short time available. So this is where there was a ball dropped. All right. I don't know what happened. I don't have the specifics. Again, this is a messenger, text communication going on. All to say is this patient was now pregnant and she was happy about it. I mean, she was like, oh, I didn't think I could get pregnant because my periods were so irregular, but had now this concern about the pregnancy's exposure, in this case, to GLP-1, specifically Ozempic. All right. Now, we're going to talk about some medications in this episode. We're going to talk about these two different classes. All right. One is the GLP-1 class, to which Ozempic belongs. We're going to talk about that, just like Rybelsus belongs to this as well. Rybelsus is very unique, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. And we're also going to talk about the SGLT2 inhibitors. Right? Those are two different types of medication. These are brand new, second-line, non-insulin diabetic meds, and you know you're going to run into a patient with this, or who's postpartum and says, hey, I want to lose some of this weight. And I had pregnancy diabetes. Can I use this medication? And if she's breastfeeding, you need to be prepared to how to answer that. And we're going to go over that in this episode. Lots to cover. All right, podcast family, as the final part of our intro, remember that our article of reference comes from JAMA Internal Medicine, officially released February 2024, just last month, but it came out ahead of print December 2023. We got lots to cover. And since Wegovy hijacked The Greatest Showman song, This Is Me, which is just a fantastic song, I thought that we would end our intro by taking that song back. So here it is, This Is Me from The Greatest Showman.
Place for us, for we are glorious. When the sharpest words want to cut me down, I'm gonna send a flood, gonna drown them out. I am brave.
just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right, everybody, fair warning. Brace yourself, Sally, because here comes your favorite history's perspective. Don't fast forward it. You're going to like it. Just hold on a minute because we all learn and appreciate from where we've been. This is fascinating, honestly. Now, we're not focusing on insulin because remember that these medications are not supposed to be the first line. That's why they are called second line non-insulin diabetic medications. And typically, they're considered adjuvants. I know people are using them just right and left, like to lose weight. And there's a place for that. But that's not how they're intended, right? They are second-line non-insulin diabetic meds. First-line, of course, if you've got diabetes type 2, you know, adult-onset diabetes, it's nutritional counseling. It is one of the traditional medications, and then these as adjuvant. Of course, people are kind of skipping that step and going right to them. Short of it is because they do work. And so this is the issue here. Now, in men, that's one thing. But since we are women's healthcare, the issue comes in when these medications are used in reproductive age women who then can potentially have a pregnancy exposed to these medications. Okay. But before I get into that, I mean, just if it hasn't been that long where we celebrated the 100th anniversary of insulin, right? Again, a true success story because the discovery of insulin came in 1921. Guys, 100 years. I mean, 1921. And before that, I mean, as we said in the intro, I mean, you were kind of a goner, right? It's like, oh, maybe just some severe nutritional diets. It was minimal carbohydrate intake. And some of those diets that are in the medical literature were like, you know, restrict dietary intake to 500 calories a day. No joke. So if it wasn't the diabetes that killed you, it was the starvation. I mean, damn. Even though insulin made its arrival on the scene in 1921, look at the story that got us there, meaning us as a medical community, to 1921. You got to go back to 1889, right? These are two German researchers that said, hey, let's take away the pancreas from this dog. I mean, what? I mean, think about this, some weird stuff, man. 1889, let's take away the pancreas from the dog and then see what happens. And sure enough, that dog basically developed symptoms of diabetes and then died. I know, it's terrible. I have a little fur baby who thinks he's actually a person, and that's terrible. But all in the name of research. All to say, they said, hey, there's some stuff coming out of the pancreas here, and it looks like it has to do with sugar control. Well, sure enough, of course, then comes 1910 with Sir Edward Albert, who said, oh my goodness, I think I can extract some of this secretion from the pancreas that's coming from these little island cells. And from island, you get insula. Did y'all get this, guys? Fascinating, right? So if the pancreatic, these little islet cells, so it secretes insula in that regard. So then the name came of insulin. So what happens? So now that they've isolated this compound, they're like, okay, I think we got this thing here that can help control sugar metabolism. Well, now it's 1921, and there's a surgeon, Frederick Banting, who figured out how to remove insulin from the dog's pancreas without actually removing the entire pancreas. That was quite a success. That's a huge jump. It's like, man, we have to sacrifice this dog. We can just take away this secretion. Anyway, so they were able to demonstrate that in a dog who basically didn't have a pancreas and was getting severe diabetes, they could keep the dog alive by giving it this extract, taking it from a dog pancreas. Crazy. That led to the development for the first time being used in 1922 when a 14-year-old boy who was dying from diabetes, this is in Toronto, Canada, guys, all right? So Toronto, here you go. And they received, this child received this injection of insulin, and within 24 hours, this dangerous condition, the boy was named Leonard Thompson, made a 180-degree recovery. I mean, just turned around, sugar levels dropped, and he's escaped death. Is that crazy or what? So from 1889 to early 1910s to a dog pancreas, and then to a 14-year-old boy, Leonard Thompson, in 1922, who was actually the first successful patient recipient of insulin. Now we are at these brand new fancy non-insulin medications. See, isn't that fascinating? I know some of you don't like that history part, and you're like, just tell me what I need to know. Well, hold on, man. You can't rush the thing. We put a lot of time into this. We do a lot of work to get here. And I just, it builds a respect of this medication that we have now. You just order from an EMR and it just goes somewhere. Man, people died without these medications. I think it gives us great perspective to know where we've come from. So very thankful for the discovery of insulin. Of course, then came all the new oral medications and hypoglycemic agents and sulfonylureas. We'll talk about all of this. And now we are at these mainly injectable options, although there is one oral medication, which is Rybelsus. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. All right, the pain is over. No more history stuff, all right? I hope you found that interesting. I just found it fascinating, and I learned about the pancreas and the dog thing. Okay, so now let's get into these newer diabetic and weight loss meds and what they actually are, how they work. Then we're going to get into the new study that officially came out in February 2024, all right? Now, we're going to talk about two classes. I already told you the first one, which was a GLP-1 agonist therapy. The first one that got approved by the FDA was in April 2005. So it's been a while, all right? That was exenatide. It's still around, but not obviously as much as the newer ones because it doesn't get any love. Okay, so exenatide was April 2005, and of course, it was for the treatment of type 2 diabetes, and since that time, you all know where we're going with this. I mean, boom, complete explosion of different options, not only for control of sugars, but also for enhanced weight loss, okay? Now, traditionally, these types of drugs, these GLP-1 agonist medications were taken by an injection, and they were either daily or weekly, and that's where we get the typical Ozempic. That's a weekly injection. That's semaglutide, but now semaglutide is also has the option of being taken by mouth, which is Rybelsus. So Rybelsus and Ozempic are brother and sister. Okay, there is semaglutide. That was approved, that's relatively recently, that just came out September 2019, okay? So there is an oral medication, it has to be taken daily, and it doesn't seem to have any decrease in efficiency or efficacy as compared to the injection. That was published in The Lancet. That study, if you're interested, is called the Pioneer 4 study, and that was, again, in The Lancet. But the oral medication, the oral form of Ozempic, which is Rybelsus, not a sponsor, again, in The Lancet Pioneer 4 study. This class of medications also includes things like Trulicity. It includes Victoza. These are all in the same class. But I'm going to show you in a minute how, even though they're in the same class, they may have different implications in pregnancy. And I said may have because we don't know the complete picture yet. But let me just spoil it for you real quick. It seems that liraglutide or Victoza, or otherwise known as Saxenda, doesn't cross the placenta at all. Okay, now you're like, well, wait a minute. Well, why is that one singled out for the others? Because there's different compositions, the way it looks, its chemical structure. And there is some data, although it's very limited, and I'm going to give you those references in a minute, that Victoza does not cross a placenta to the degree that something like Ozempic does. Okay, so even though that may be the case on a lab model and with one case report that I'm going to show you in a minute, still, it's a no-go. So don't use these unless there's some overwhelming, compelling reason that you really have to, because, again, the data, while it looks reassuring, especially for periconception use, the truth is we just don't know that much about it and its safety in pregnancy, okay? So just steer clear unless, like in this one case report that I'm going to read you, there's just, like, no other reason, no other option, and you got to use it, which I'd find that hard to believe. Nonetheless, remember that GLP-1 medications seem to have two targets, okay? One is in the CNS, and then the other is in the GI tract. This is how they help to reduce appetite. They have delayed glucose absorption due to the slower gastric emptying. So there's different mechanisms of action here. Plus, remember that research has also found that some of the drugs in this class can help reduce the risk of heart disease and heart failure and stroke and even kidney disease. So there's a lot of different reasons. And there's even some hypertensive control that these medications can do because they can help with nitric oxide production, specifically drugs like Victoza. Okay, those are seem to be very cardioprotective. So a lot of mechanisms of action that are super helpful outside of pregnancy. So that's the catch here. If this medication is thinking about being used, use it. If the patient meets criteria, just make sure that in a reproductive age female, you address this issue of unclear safety in pregnancy. So there, I've kind of spilled the beans, okay, because even though this publication from February 2024 is very reassuring, it is very early data. And there's a lot of gaps. However, if you search for this online, you would think that it's a clear-cut story. These things are safe. There's no increased risk in malformations, and it's all clear. And the risk of miscarriage is not any higher than that baseline of a diabetic who gets pregnant. Wait a minute. There's a lot to unpack there. That's why you can't just read a headline. Because I'm telling you guys, when we prepared for this, several medical sites are like, oh, brand new, second line, non-insulin diabetic medications, safe in pregnancy. Wait, what? Wait a minute. It's early data. It's a big study. Now, I mean, we're going to get into that. Remember, that's the whole, that's the center meal of our dinner here. Is this JAMA publication from February. And it is super reassuring, but there's lots of issues that the authors self say, hey guys, this looks okay, but here are the issues with this study, and we're going to cover some of that here. And just to be clear, what GLP-1 actually means, remember that's glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist. So that is an agonist that works mainly on the pancreas to enhance insulin release, and it leads to a reduced glucagon response after a glucose load, all right? So you don't get this huge spike. It helps maintain that in addition to the other effects that we already talked about. So remember, so one medication is a receptor agonist. That is the glucagon-like peptide 1 or GLP-1. And then you have the other one, which is the SGLT2, which stands for sodium glucose cotransporter number 2. That is an inhibitor, right? You all see the mechanism of action, very different. So one works mainly at the pancreas. That is a receptor agonist. That is GLP-1, like Ozempic. And then you have SGLT2, which is the sodium glucose cotransporter 2, that works mainly in the proximal tubal of the kidney. This results in loss of glucose, so it's glucosuria and natriuresis, all right? So it puts out sodium and glucose. So they work totally different ways, but still listed as these newer agents for diabetic control and for weight loss, all right? So sodium glucose cotransporter 2, or SGLT2, that is a inhibitor, and then the GLP-1 is a receptor agonist like Ozempic. All right, I know that's painful, but we got to know what we're talking about here, okay? Oh, and here's a big catch. So even though both medications are ex-nate in pregnancy, you don't want to use those, and you don't want to have it periconceptionally, although this new data that we're about to cover is more reassuring, but still it's try not to use it in pregnancy or periconception. There is one big factor here. This is a big clinical pearl for the SGLT2 inhibitors, right? The ones that work in the kidney, is that already type 1 diabetes in pregnancy is associated with an increased risk of ketoacidosis, right? Well, that risk may be exacerbated by SGLT2 inhibitors. So that's a little clinical pearl. Outside of the issue of safety and potential harms on the fetus, there is this potential with type 1 diabetes. We're not talking about type 2 diabetes, but with type 1 true diabetes as a child, type 1 diabetes and these medications in pregnancy, there seems to be this increased risk of ketoacidosis. All right, fine. All that is just background stuff. Because remember, we're not trying to use this in pregnancy, although that one wacky case report actually did. And it actually found some remarkable stuff. I'll tell you here in a minute. But the majority is going to be for us as women's healthcare providers who deal with pregnancy. Hey, I'm on these medications, whether it's GLP-1 or SGLT2, and now I'm pregnant. So what does the data say about first trimester exposure? Well, now we've got this new data that this is exactly what we're going to talk about here that is reassuring, but large gaps in the data. Now, remember, based on what has already been known and submitted to the FDA, based on animal models, okay, and very limited human reproductive studies, we know that these medications in certain animal scenarios, like with pregnant rats and in certain kinds of monkey species that were exposed to this, it did increase the risk of early pregnancy loss, so miscarriage, and potentially some congenital anomalies, all right? So as of right now, that's why you don't use it in those who are pregnant or seeking pregnancy in the short term. It's no-go. There is some animal data that these are harmful. That's why we desperately need human studies, and this is where this new data is going, okay? This is why, as we just mentioned a little while ago, that semaglutide, which is Ozempic, the FDA says if you're going to try to get pregnant, use the last shot and give it 2 to 3 months before you attempt pregnancy. Just give it that washout interval, okay? And that's at least 2 to 3 months. That seems to be safe in that time. Although here's the clinical pearl that the two that do not seem to cross the placenta in the GLP-1 family are liraglutide and exenatide. Those are the two that seem to not get by the barrier. So that's something that potentially could be interesting down the road, but still as a class, it is no go. Okay. Now let's get into some of the data, having said that, because I don't want this to be too long. In 2015, a case report with an N of 1, that's right, a whopping N of 1, reported on an OB outcome in a 37-year-old patient who had type 2 diabetes who exposed to this medication in the first trimester, right? Specifically, GLP-1 medication. This was in the journal Diabetic Medicine. Now, in this case, this 37-year-old woman with type 2 diabetes had been taking liraglutide for 2 years and then was admitted in the 13th week of pregnancy for diabetic control. Like, oh, I've been on it all this time. Okay. So the medication, liraglutide, was immediately discontinued and IV therapy was started. Fine. So the woman gave birth to a healthy child and there was no adverse issues found. So the authors concluded, quote, although the present normal pregnancy outcome does not mean that glucagon-like peptide 1 analogs are safe to use in pregnancy, this report contributes to the limited knowledge regarding human exposure to these medications during pregnancy in women with diabetes, end quote. So it was an N of 1. Now, when this came out in 2015 and then other publications started to follow, we're like, well, no wonder this patient seemed to do well. It seems that liraglutide does not cross the placenta. So, duh. So if the question is, well, if that's the case, why are we using this one more? Well, because it's still part of the class. And as a class, it's no-go in pregnancy or periconception. Although there is some evidence, again, that liraglutide does not cross the placenta, as well as exenatide. Those are the two medications in the GLP-1 medication family that seem to be protected. Let's hover here for just a minute on this liraglutide and pregnancy issue. So there's a paper that came out of Croatia, okay? And yeah, there's crazy. Look, man, I'm so thankful for this team that they do some fantastic research. But Gynecological Perinatology 2018, the title of this translated publication is Pregnancy Outcome and Liraglutide Levels in Serum and Umbilical Vein Blood of a Woman with Type 2 Diabetes, a Case Report. Perfect, right? So again, I don't know if this study would fly here in the U.S., or North America, but nonetheless, here's what they did. So there's a 28-year-old patient with type 2 diabetes for 7 years. Okay, let me just read this exactly from here because you're like, wow, that is so whack and so amazingly brave and scientifically curious that it's ballsy. Okay, so let me read this to you. Quote, in spite of high insulin dose, her glycemia was poorly controlled. She developed dyslipidemia and her body weight increased. Now, remember, she's pregnant, so yeah, that could be pregnancy, but nonetheless, quote, thus, her diabetologist prescribed liraglutide injections and metformin. So remember, she's already on insulin, right? So she's kind of like maxed out on insulin. So her diabetic physician says, hey, let's give you liraglutide and metformin. And they go on to say, quote, at booking, so I guess that's like at initiation of prenatal care, at booking, obstetrical ultrasound confirmed intrauterine pregnancy of 8 gestational weeks. The patient was informed about all possible consequences for her fetus that might be caused by liraglutide therapy during pregnancy. She continued her treatment with liraglutide and metformin medication throughout her pregnancy. End quote. So let's stop there. Okay. FDA would just go batshit crazy. Okay. Because you're like, you did what? But I mean, what else are you going to do? Right? I mean, if your sugars are that out of whack, you're going to risk DKA. You got to do something. If the patient has informed consent, again, I told you, this is incredibly scientifically and amazingly ballsy. So here's what they said. Quote, her pregnancy was stopped by elective cesarean section at 39 gestational weeks. A healthy newborn male was delivered. The concentration, here it is, guys, of liraglutide was measured in maternal and umbilical vein serum. Okay, here it is, guys. Listen to this. This isn't an animal model, this or a placenta model. This was in a person. So here's what they found. Quote, there was no significant transfer of liraglutide from the circulation of the treated mother to her fetus at least 3.5 hours after the drug was administered. End quote. There you go. So having had that data in 2018, that's why people criticize that 2015 publication, that single case report, number one, because it was N of one, but they're like, well, you said everything was fine, probably because it didn't cross the placenta. Super interesting, right? But just remember that liraglutide is not the medication Ozempic. That's a whole different thing, because remember that the brother and sister combination is semaglutide. Oral, it is Rybelsus, and as a weekly injection, it is Ozempic, but that is semaglutide. So it's in the same class, but it just makes the point that even though they're in the same group, they may function differently. This is why this latest data out of JAMA Internal Medicine is super helpful, even though it's got its issues and its limitations. Remember, this officially came out December 2023, but out in print February 2024. This study did provide some, quote, reassuring, end quote, and that's the word that the authors used, early evidence that taking these non-insulin anti-diabetic meds for type 2 diabetes, including GLP-1 receptor agonists, seems to not have a higher risk of birth defects. Now, things like miscarriage, stillbirth, that data was in the background, right? They were really looking for major malformations up to following these children up to 1 year after birth. Now, here's why this made a lot of news. One is we didn't have anything like this before, but it crossed different countries. It's fantastic. It included data from 4 Nordic countries, the U.S. MarketScan database, and the Israeli Maccabi Health Services database. There's a lot of patients, a lot of info that went into this publication, over 50,000 patients, okay? But now here's the catch. In these 50,000 patients who were, again, followed up to 1 year postpartum for their child, they followed their prescription filling 4 sulfonylurea medication, DPP-4 inhibitors, which is a whole other class of anti-diabetic meds we're not going to get into right now, but just know that there are another class that stands for dipeptylpeptidase 4, DPP-4 inhibitors, all in the same major family of second-line anti-diabetic non-insulin medications, right? But it also included, of course, as we're talking about here, GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors. And it included insulin as well as the comparator. Now, the way that they did this is, let's take a look at who fills one of these medications from 90 days before pregnancy until the end of the first trimester when they were diagnosed with pregnancy early on. Okay, now that's going to be one of the big limitations, is that this was looking at filling of medications. Just because they got the medication filled don't mean that they took it. Y'all see that, right? Not only that, but when did they take it? Did they take it specifically around the crucial times of organogenesis? So that's a huge, huge gap here that I didn't find out. I mean, it's obvious, but the authors are very open. Hey, we got this issue. It was based on prescription filling. They may or may not have taken it. We don't know that. And we don't know exactly when they took it. It was up to 3 months before pregnancy or the end of the first trimester. So periconceptionally. Remember, the actual number was about 51,000 patients. These all had type 2 diabetes, no type 1. And here's the big take-home message. The highest risk of malformations was actually in the group who took sulfonylureas, which is interesting because I didn't think we use those very much anymore, but sulfonylureas. Anyway, so that class of medication had the highest rate of some kind of malformation at 9.7%. Okay, now here's what the individual risk per medication class look like. Here's the adjusted risk ratios based on drug exposure. Okay, ready? This is all compared, of course, to insulin. And this is looking for not minor issues, but major congenital malformations. The risk ratio was 1.18 for exposure to sulfonylureas. And that was the highest, okay, 1.18. For the DPP-4 inhibitors, again, that's another class, it was 0.83. For the GLP-1 receptor agonist, like our patient took, it was 0.95, so it was less than 1. Even though our focus has really been on the GLP-1 receptor agonist, because that's what our patient was on in our little patient scenario here, where she was on Ozempic, the data is not any more innocent for SGLT2 inhibitors. Based on some of the data, especially when used in animal models beyond the first trimester, because remember, these have a main target in the kidney, this seems to have caused some renal pelvic dilation and some renal issues, but that's when it's used in second and third trimester, all right? And that's typically, remember, not how we would use these medications, but I don't want to make it seem like the SGLT2 inhibitors are somehow innocent. Both of them are exonate in pregnancy until there is clear data of safety. Again, this JAMA Internal Medicine report is very reassuring as early data, but we still need a lot more. Now that we've covered all of that, where are we? What does this mean for clinical practice? Okay, well, there are some main clinical implications here. Number one, if we're going to use these medications of either of the two classes in a reproductive age female, please stress that pregnancy is not allowed or recommended, nor is it allowed or recommended within 2 to 3 months after stopping either of these medications. That's number one. You've got to be on good birth control because this issue can be prevented. Number two is if you do have a patient who becomes pregnant on these medications, remember that the manufacturer through the FDA does have a registry. They can put in that data because we need to build that database so that we can know what to do down the road. So that's a good reminder. Third is that even though there are big, big limitations in the safety data, as of right now, with what we have, which is basically the biggest database yet from officially released February 2024, last month, it seems that GLP-1 medications, as well as the SGLT2 inhibitors, if they do get pregnant and have exposure early in pregnancy, it seems to not be that worrisome, even though risk of miscarriage is related to the overall diabetic condition and or obesity. Those, both of those are independent factors for loss. But for major malformation, it seems to be okay, so we can talk patients down from that. And then the last clinical implication before we wrap this up is very simple. If a patient wants to use this during lactation, during breastfeeding, the answer is still no. Now, if they come back and go, hey, but I'm not pregnant anymore, right? But nonetheless, we just do not have that safety information. So as of right now, these newer medications, considered non-insulin, second-line diabetic meds, are not recommended for pregnancy, not recommended in those desiring pregnancy, and not recommended for lactation. All right, let's bring this home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. We've got to know what to tell patients if they get pregnant on these medications. This is a fast-growing area of medicine, and more data, I'm sure, is on the way. As always, we're thankful for you. We're glad you're part of our podcast community, and we'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.